as if she were remembering what had happened to her that day.
"I was really scared,"
she said.
"I guess that's what I wanted you to feel. I guess I wanted you to hear the sound of the thing chewing you up."
I lowered myself into a deck chair and looked at the body of Mei Kasahara, hardly covered by her little bikini. She was 16 years old, but she had the build of a girl of 13 or 14. Her breasts and hips were far from fully matured. Her body reminded me of those drawings that use the absolute minimum of line, yet still give a vivid sense of reality. But still at the same time, there was something about it that gave an impression of extreme old age. Then all of a sudden, it occurred to me to ask her, "Have you ever had the feeling that you've been defiled by something?"
"Defiled?"
She looked at me, her eyes narrowed.
"You mean physically? You mean raped?"
"Physically, mentally, either." Mei Kasahara looked down at her own body, then returned her gaze to me.
"Physically, no. I mean, I'm still a virgin. I've let a boy fill me up, but just through my clothes."
I nodded.
"Mentally, I'm not sure. I don't really know what it means to be defiled mentally."
"Neither do I," I said. "It's just a question of whether you feel it's happened to you or not. If you don't feel it, that probably means you haven't been defiled."
"Why are you asking me about this?"
"Because some of the people I know have that feeling, and it causes all kinds of complicated problems. There's one thing I want to ask you, though."
"Why are you always thinking about death?"
She put a cigarette between her lips and nimbly struck a match with one hand. Then she put on her sunglasses.
"You mean you don't think much about death, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?"
"I do think about death, of course, but not all the time. Just once in a while, like most people."
"Here's what I think, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,"
said Mei Kasahara.
"Everybody's born with some different thing at the core of their existence, and that thing, whatever it is, becomes like a heat source that runs each person from the inside. I have one too, of course, like everybody else, but sometimes it gets out of hand. It swells or shrinks inside me, and it shakes me up. What I'd really like to do is find a way to communicate that feeling to another person. But I can't seem to do it. They just don't get it. Of course, the problem could be that I'm not explaining it very well, but I think it's because they're not listening very well. They pretend to be listening, but they're not really, so I get worked up sometimes. And I do some crazy things."
"Crazy things?"
"Like, say, trapping you in the well, or like when I'm riding on the back of a motorcycle, putting my hands over the eyes of the guy who's driving."
When she said this, she touched the wound next to her eye. "And that's how the motorcycle accident happened?" I asked. Mei Kasahara gave me a questioning look, as if she had not heard me. I couldn't make out the expression in her eyes behind the dark glasses, but a kind of numbness seemed to have spread over her face like oil poured on still water. "What happened to the guy?" I asked. With her cigarette between her lips, Mei Kasahara continued to look at me. Or rather, she continued to look at my mark.
"Do I have to answer that question, Mr. Wind-Up Bird?"
"Not if you don't want to. You're the one who brought it up. If you don't want to talk about it, then don't." Mei Kasahara grew very quiet. She seemed to be having trouble deciding what to do. Then she drew in a chestful of cigarette smoke and let it out slowly. With a heavy movement, she dragged her sunglasses off and turned her face to the sun, eyes closed tight. Watching her, I felt as if the flow of time were slowing down little by little, as if time's spring were beginning to run down.
"He died,"
she said at last, in a voice with no expression, as though she had resigned herself to something.
"He died?"
Mei Kasahara tapped the ash off her cigarette. Then she picked up her towel and wiped the sweat from her face over and over again. Finally, as if recalling a task that she had forgotten, she said in a clipped, business-like way,
"We were going pretty fast. It happened near Enoshima."
I looked at her without a word. She held an edge of the beach towel in each hand, pressing the edges against her cheeks. White smoke was rising from the cigarette between her fingers. With no wind to disturb it, the smoke rose straight up, like a miniature smoke signal. She seemed to be having trouble deciding whether to cry or to laugh. At least it looked that way to me. She wavered on the narrow line that divided one possibility from the other, but in the end she fell to neither side. Mei Kasahara pulled her expression together, put the towel on the ground, and took a drag on her cigarette. The time was nearly 5 o'clock, but the heat showed no sign of abating.
"I killed him,"
she said.
"Of course, I didn't mean to kill him. I just wanted to push the limits. We did stuff like that all the time. It was like a game. I'd cover his eyes or tickle him when we were on the bike, but nothing ever happened. Until that day."
Mei Kasahara raised her face and looked straight at me.
"Anyway, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, no, I don't feel as if I've been defiled. I just wanted to get close to that gooshy thing if I could. I wanted to trick it into coming out of me and then crush it to bits. You've got to really push the limits if you're going to trick it into coming out. It's the only way. You've got to offer it good bait."
She shook her head slowly.
"No, I don't think I've been defiled. But I haven't been saved either. There's nobody who can save me right now, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. The world looks totally empty to me. Everything I see around me looks fake. The only thing that isn't fake is that gooshy thing inside me."
Mei Kasahara sat there for a long time, taking small, regular breaths. There were no other sounds, no bird or insect cries. A terrible quiet settled over the yard, as though the world had become empty. Mei Kasahara turned to face me. She seemed just then to have remembered something. Now all expression was gone from her face, as if she'd been washed clean.
"Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, did you sleep with that Cretacano person?"
I nodded.
"Will you write to me from Crete?"
asked Mei Kasahara. "Sure I will, if I go."
"You know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,"
she said after some hesitation,
"I think I might be going back to school."
"Oh, so you've changed your mind about school?" She gave a little shrug.
"It's a different one. I refuse to go back to my old school. The new one's far from here. So anyway, I probably won't see you for a while."
I nodded. Then I took a lemon drop from my pocket and put it into my mouth. Mei Kasahara glanced around and lit up a cigarette.
"Tell me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, is it fun to sleep with a bunch of different women?"
"That's beside the point."
"Yeah, I've heard that one already."
"Right," I said, but I didn't know what else to say.
"Oh, forget it. But you know, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, it's because I met you that I finally decided to go back to school. No kidding."
"Why's that?" I asked.
"Yeah, why is that?"
Mei Kasahara said. Then she wrinkled up the corners of her eyes and looked at me.
"Maybe I wanted to go back to a more normal world. But really, Mr. Wind-Up Bird, it's been a lot of fun being with you. No kidding. I mean, you're such a super normal guy, but you do such unnormal things, and you're so, what, unpredictable. So hanging around with you hasn't been boring in any way. You have no idea how much good that's done me. Not being bored means not having to think about a lot of stupid stuff, right? So where that's concerned, I'm glad you've been around. But to tell you the truth, it's made me nervous, too."
"In what way?"
"Well, how can I put this? Sometimes when I'm looking at you, I get this feeling like maybe you're fighting real hard against something for me. I know this sounds weird, but when that happens, I feel like I'm right with you, sweating with you. See what I mean? You always look so cool. Like no matter what happens, it's got nothing to do with you, but you're not really like that. In your own way, you're out there fighting as hard as you can, even if other people can't tell by looking at you. If you weren't, you wouldn't have gone into the well like that, right? But anyhow, you're not fighting for me, of course. You're falling all over yourself, trying to wrestle with this big whatever it is, and the only reason you're doing it is so you can find Kumiko. So there's no point in me getting all sweaty for you. I know all that. But still, I can't help feeling that you are fighting for me, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. That in a way, You're probably fighting for a lot of other people at the same time you're fighting for Kumiko. And that's maybe why you look like an absolute idiot sometimes. That's what I think, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. But when I see you doing this, I get all tense and nervous. And I end up feeling totally drained. I mean, it looks like you can't possibly win. If I had to bet on the match, I'd bet on you to lose. Sorry, but that's how it is. I like you a lot, but I don't want to go broke.
I understand completely.
I don't want to watch you going under, and I don't want to sweat any more for you than I already have. That's why I've decided to go back to a world that's a little more normal. But if I hadn't met you here in front of this vacant house, I don't think things would have turned out this way. I never would have thought about going back to school. I'd still be hanging around in some not-so-normal world. So in that sense, it's all because of you, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. You're not totally useless.
I nodded. It was the first time in a long time that anyone had said anything nice about me.
Come here, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
said Mei Kasahara. She raised herself up in her deck chair. I got out of my chair and went to hers.
Sit down right here, Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
said Mei Kasahara. I did as I was told and sat down next to her.
Show me your face, Mr. Wind-Up Bird.
She stared at me for a time. Then, placing one hand on my knee, she pressed the palm of the other against the mark on my cheek.
Poor Mr. Wind-Up Bird,
said Mei Kasahara in a near whisper.
I know you're going to take on all kinds of things, even before you know it. And you won't have any choice in the matter. The way rain falls in a field. And now close your eyes, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. Really tight. Like they're glued shut.
I closed my eyes tight. Mei Kasahara touched her lips to my mark. Her lips were small and thin, like an extremely well-made imitation. Then she parted those lips and ran her tongue across my mark, very slowly, covering every bit of it. The hand she had placed on my knee remained there the whole time. Its warm, moist touch came to me from far away, from a place still farther than if it had passed through all the fields in the world. Then she took my hand and touched it to the wound beside her eye. I caressed the half-inch scar. As I did so, the waves of her consciousness pulsed through my fingertips and into me, a delicate resonance of longing. Someone should take this girl in his arms and hold her tight, I thought. Probably someone other than me. Someone qualified to give her something.
Goodbye, Mr. Wind-Up Bird. See you again sometime.
16. The simplest thing. Revenge in a sophisticated form. The thing in the guitar case. The next day I called my uncle and told him I might be moving out of the house sometime in the next few weeks. I apologized for springing it on him so suddenly, but explained that it was because Kumiko had left me, with just as little warning. There was no point in covering up any more. I told him that she had written to say she would not be coming back, and that I wanted to get away from this place, though exactly for how long I could not be sure. My summary explanation was followed by a thoughtful silence at my uncle's end of the line. He seemed to be mulling something over. Then he said,
"Mind if I come over there for a visit sometime soon? I'd like to see with my own eyes what's going on, and I haven't been to the house for quite a while now."
My uncle came to the house 2 evenings later. He looked at my mark, but had nothing to say about it. He probably didn't know what to say. He just gave it a funny look, with his eyes narrowed.
He had brought me a good bottle of scotch and a pack of fish-paste cakes that he had bought in Odawara. We sat on the veranda, eating the cakes and drinking the whiskey.
"What a pleasure it is to be sitting on a veranda again,"
my uncle said, nodding several times.
"Our condo doesn't have one, of course. Sometimes I really miss this place. There's a special feeling you get on a veranda that you just can't get anywhere else."
For a while he sat there, gazing at the moon, a slim, white crescent of a moon that looked as if someone had just finished sharpening it. That such a thing could go on floating in the sky seemed almost miraculous to me. Then, in an utterly offhand manner, my uncle asked,
"How'd you get that mark?"
"I really don't know," I said, and took a gulp of whiskey. "All of a sudden it was there. Maybe a week ago? I wish I could explain it better, but I just don't know how."
"Did you go to the doctor?"
I shook my head.
"I don't want to stick my nose in where I'm not wanted, but just let me say this. You really ought to sit down and think hard about what it is that's most important to you."
I nodded. "I have been thinking about that," I said. "But things are so complicated and tangled up, I can't seem to separate them out and do one thing at a time. I don't know how to untangle things." My uncle smiled.
"You know what I think? I think what you ought to do is start by thinking about the simplest things and go from there. For example, you could stand on a street corner somewhere day after day and look at the people who come by. You're not in any hurry to decide anything. It may be tough, but sometimes you've got to just stop and take time. You ought to train yourself to look at things with your own eyes until something becomes clear. And don't be afraid of putting some time into it. Spending plenty of time on something can be the most sophisticated form of revenge."
"Revenge? What do you mean, revenge? Revenge against whom?"
"You'll understand soon enough," said my uncle, with a smile.
All told, we sat on the veranda drinking together for something over an hour. Then, announcing that he had stayed too long, my uncle stood up and left. Alone again, I sat on the veranda, leaning against a pillar and staring out at the garden under the moon. For a time, I was able to breathe deeply the air of realism, or whatever it was that my uncle left behind, and to feel, for the first time in a very long time, a sense of genuine relief. Within a few hours, though, that air began to dissipate, and a kind of cloak of pale sorrow came to envelop me once again. In the end, I was in my world again, and my uncle was in his. My uncle had said that I should think about the simplest things first, but I found it impossible to distinguish between what was simple and what was difficult. And so, the next morning, after the rush hour had ended, I took the train to Shinjuku. I decided just to stand there and look at people's faces. I didn't know if it would do any good, but it was probably better than doing nothing. If looking at people's faces until you got sick of them was an example of a simple thing, then it couldn't hurt to give it a try. If it went well, it just might give me some indication of what constituted the simple things for me. The first day, I spent 2 full hours sitting on the low brick wall that ran along the edge of the raised flower bed outside Shinjuku Station, watching the faces of the people who passed by. But the sheer numbers of people were too great, and they walked too quickly. I couldn't manage a good look at any one person's face. To make matters worse, some homeless guy came over to me after I had been there for a while and started haranguing me about something. A policeman came by several times, glaring at me. So I gave up on the busy area outside the station and decided to look for a place better suited to the leisurely study of passers-by. I went along the passageway under the tracks on the west side of the station, and after I had spent some time walking around, I found a small tiled plaza outside a glass high-rise. It had a little sculpture and some handsome benches where I could sit and look at people as much as I liked. The numbers were nowhere near as great as outside the main entrance of the station, and there weren't any homeless guys here with bottles of whiskey stuck in their pockets. I spent the day there, making do for lunch with some doughnuts and coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and going home before the evening rush. At first, the only ones who caught my eye were the men with thinning hair,
thanks to the training I had received doing surveys with Mei Kasahara for the toupee maker. Before I knew it, my gaze would lock onto a bald head, and I'd have the man classified as A, B, or C. At this rate, I might just as well have called Mei Kasahara and volunteered to join her for work again. After a few days had gone by, though, I found myself capable of just sitting and watching people's faces without a thought in my head. Most of the ones who passed by were men and women who worked in offices in the high-rise. The men wore white shirts and ties and carried briefcases. The women mostly wore high-heeled shoes. Others I saw included patrons of the building's restaurants and shops, family groups headed for the observation deck on the top floor, and a few people who were just passing through, walking from point A to point B. Most of the people tended not to walk very quickly. I just let myself watch them all without any clear purpose. From time to time there would be people who attracted my interest for some reason or other, and then I would concentrate on their faces and follow them with my eyes. Every day, I would take the train to Shinjuku at 10 o'clock, after the rush hour, sit on the bench in the plaza, and stay there almost motionless until 4, staring at people's faces. Only after I had tried this out did I realize that by training my eyes on one passing face after another, I was able to empty my head completely, like pulling the cork from a bottle. I spoke to no one, and no one spoke to me. I thought nothing. I felt nothing. I often had the sense that I'd become part of the stone bench. Someone did speak to me once, though. A thin, well-dressed middle-aged woman. She wore a bright pink, tight-fitting dress, dark sunglasses with tortoiseshell frames, and a white hat, and she carried a white mesh handbag. She had nice legs, and had on expensive-looking spotless white leather sandals. Her makeup was thick, but not offensively so. She asked me if I was in some kind of difficulty. Not at all, I replied. I seem to see you here every day, she said, and asked what I was doing. I said I was looking at people's faces. She asked if I was doing it for some purpose, and I said I was not. Sitting down beside me, she took a pack of Virginia Slims from her bag and lit up with a small gold lighter. She offered me one, but I shook my head. Then she took off her sunglasses and, without a word, stared at my face. More precisely, she stared at the mark on my face. In return, I stared back into her eyes. But I was unable to read any emotion stirring there. I saw nothing but two dark pupils that seemed to be functioning as they were meant to. She had a small, pointed nose, her lips were thin, and color had been applied to them with great care. I found it hard to guess her age, but I supposed she was in her mid-40s. She looked younger than that at first glance, but the lines on either side of her nose had a special kind of weariness about them.
"Do you have any money?"
she asked. This caught me off guard. "Money? What do you mean, do I have any money?"
"I'm just asking, do you have any money? Are you broke?"
"No, at the moment I'm not broke," I said. She drew her lips to one side as if examining what I had said and continued to concentrate all her attention on me. Then she nodded, and then she put her sunglasses on, dropped her cigarette to the ground, rose gracefully from her seat, and without a glance in my direction, slipped away. Amazed, I watched her disappear into the crowd. Maybe she was a little crazy, but her immaculate grooming made that hard to believe. I stepped on her discarded cigarette, crushing it out, and then I did a slow scan of my surroundings, which turned out to be filled with the normal real world. People were moving from one place to another, each with his or her own purpose. I didn't know who they were, and they didn't know who I was. I took a deep breath and went back to my task of looking at the faces of these people, without a thought in my head. I went on sitting there for 11 days altogether. Every day I had my coffee and donuts and did nothing but watch the faces of the people passing by. Aside from the meaningless little conversation with the well-dressed woman who approached me, I spoke with no one for the whole 11 days. I did nothing special, and nothing special happened to me. Even after this 11-day vacuum, however, I was unable to come to any conclusion. I was still lost in a complex maze, unable to solve the simplest problem. But then, on the evening of the 11th day, something very strange occurred.
It was a Sunday, and I had stayed there watching faces until later than usual. The people who came to Shinjuku on a Sunday were different from the weekday crowd, and there was no rush hour. I caught sight of a young man with a black guitar case. He was of average height. He wore glasses with black plastic frames, had hair down to his shoulders, was dressed in blue denim jacket and jeans, and trudged along in worn-out trainers. He walked past me, looking straight ahead, a thoughtful expression in his eyes. When I saw him, something struck me. My heart gave a thump. "I know that guy," I thought. "I've seen him somewhere." But it took me a few seconds to remember who he was. The singer I had seen that night in the snack bar in Sapporo. No doubt about it. It was him. I leapt from my bench and hurried after him. Given his leisurely pace, it was not difficult to catch up with him. I followed 10 steps behind, adjusting my pace to his. I considered the possibility of speaking to him. I would say something like, "You were singing 3 years ago in Sapporo, weren't you? I heard you there." "Oh, really?" he would say. "Thank you very much." And then what? Should I say, "My wife had an abortion that night, and she left me not too long ago. She'd been sleeping with another man?" I decided just to follow him and see what happened. Maybe as I walked along I would figure out a way to handle it. He was walking away from the station. He passed beyond the string of high-rises, crossed the Ome Highway, and headed for Yoyogi. He seemed to be deep in thought. Apparently at home in the area, he never once hesitated or looked around. He kept walking at the same pace, facing straight ahead. I followed after him, thinking about the day that Kumiko had her abortion. Sapporo, in early March. The earth was hard and frozen, and now and then a few snowflakes had fluttered down. I was back in those streets, my lungs full of frozen air. I saw the white breath coming from people's mouths. Then it hit me. That was when things had started to change. Yes, definitely. That had been a turning point. After that, the flow around me had begun to show signs of change. Now that I thought about it, that abortion had been an event of great significance for the two of us. At the time, however, I had not been able to perceive its true importance. I had been too distracted by the act of abortion itself, while the genuinely important thing may have been something else entirely. "I had to do it," she said. "I felt it was the right thing to do, the best thing for both of us. But there's something else, something you don't know about, something I can't put into words just yet. I'm not hiding anything from you. I just can't be sure whether or not it's something real, which is why I can't put it into words yet." Back then, she couldn't be sure that that something was real. And that something, without a doubt, had been more connected with the pregnancy than with the abortion. Maybe it had had something to do with the child in her womb. What could it have been? What had sent her into such confusion? Had she had relations with another man and refused to give birth to his baby? No, that was out of the question. She herself had declared that it was out of the question. It had been my child, that was certain. But still, there had been something she was unable to tell me, and that something was inextricably connected to her decision to leave me. Everything had started from that. But what the secret was, what had been concealed there, I had no idea. I was the only one left alone, the only one in the dark. All I knew for certain was that as long as I failed to solve the secret of that something, Kumiko would never come back to me. I began to sense a quiet anger growing inside my body, an anger directed towards that something that remained invisible to me. I stretched my back, drew in a deep breath, and calmed the pounding of my heart. Even so, the anger, like water, seeped into every corner of my body. It was an anger steeped in sorrow. There was no way for me to smash it against something. Nothing I could do to dispel it. The man went on walking at the same steady pace. He crossed the Odakyu line tracks, past a block of shops, through a shrine, through a labyrinth of alleys. I followed after him, adjusting my distance so as to keep him from spotting me. And it was clear that he had not spotted me. He never once looked around. There was definitely something about this man that made him different from ordinary people.
Not only did he never look back, he never once looked to either side. He was so utterly concentrated. What could he be thinking about? Or was he, rather, thinking about absolutely nothing? Before long, the man entered a hushed area of deserted streets lined with two-story wood-frame houses. The road was narrow and twisted, and the run-down houses were jammed up against each other on either side. The lack of people here was almost weird. More than half the houses were vacant. Boards were nailed across the front doors of the vacant houses, and applications for planning permission were posted outside. Here and there, like missing teeth, were vacant lots filled with summer weeds and surrounded by chain-link fences. There was probably a plan to demolish this whole area in the near future and put up some new high-rises. Pots of morning glories and other flowers crammed the little space outside one of the few houses that were occupied. A tricycle lay on its side, and a towel and a child's bathing suit were being dried in the second-story window. Cats lay everywhere, beneath the windows, in the doorway, watching me with weary eyes. Despite the early evening hour, there was no sign of people. The geography of this place confounded me. I couldn't tell north from south. I guessed that I was in the triangular area between Yoyogi and Sendagaya and Harajuku, but I could not be sure. It was, in any case, a forgotten section of the city. It had most likely been overlooked because the roads were so narrow that cars could hardly pass through. The hands of the developers had not reached this far. Stepping in here, I felt as if time had turned back 20 or 30 years. I realized that at some point the constant roar of car engines had been swallowed up and was now gone. Carrying his guitar case, the man had made his way through the maze of streets until he came to a wood-frame apartment house. He opened the front door, went inside, and closed the door behind him. As far as I could see, the door had not been locked. I stood there for a time. The hands of my watch showed 6:20. I leaned against the chain-link fence of the vacant lot across the street, observing the building. It was a typical two-floor wood-frame apartment building. The look of the entrance and the layout of the rooms gave it away. I had lived in a building like this for a time when I was a student. There had been a shoe cabinet in the hallway, a shared toilet, a little kitchen, and only students or single working people lived there. This particular building, though, gave no sense of anyone living there. It was devoid of sound or movement. The plastic veneer door bore no nameplate. Where it had been removed, there was a long, narrow blank. All the windows of the place were shut tight, with curtains drawn, despite the lingering afternoon heat. This apartment house, like its neighbors, was probably scheduled for demolition soon, and no one lived there any longer. But if that was true, what was the man with the guitar case doing here? I expected to see a window slide open after he went inside, but still, nothing moved.
I couldn't just go on hanging around forever in this deserted alley.
I walked over to the front door and gave it a push. I had been right. It was not locked, and it opened in easily. I stood in the doorway a moment, trying to get a sense of the place. But I could hardly make out anything in the gloomy interior. With the windows all closed, the place was filled with hot, stale air. The moldy smell reminded me of the air at the bottom of the well. My armpits were streaming in the heat. A drop of sweat ran down behind my ear. After a moment's hesitation, I stepped inside and quietly closed the door behind me. By checking the name tags, if there were any, on the mailboxes or the shoe cabinet, I intended to find out if anyone was still living here. But before I could do so, I realized that someone was there. Someone was watching me. To the right of the entrance stood a tall shoe cabinet or some such thing, and the someone was standing just beyond it, as if hiding. I held my breath and peered into the gloomy warmth. The person standing there was the young man with the guitar case. It was obvious he had been hiding behind the shoe cabinet from the time he entered. My heart pounded at the base of my throat like a hammer smashing a nail. What was he doing here? Waiting for me? "Hello there," I forced myself to say. "I was hoping to ask you..." But the words were barely out of my mouth when something slammed into my shoulder. Hard.
I couldn't tell what was happening. All I felt at that moment was a physical impact of blinding intensity. I went on standing there, confused. But the next second, I realized what was going on. With the agility of a monkey, the man had leaped out from behind the shoe cabinet and hit me with a baseball bat. While I stood there in shock, he raised the bat again and swung it at me. I tried to dodge, but I was too late. This time the bat hit my left arm. For a moment the arm lost all feeling. There was no pain, nothing at all. It was as if the whole arm had just melted into space. Before I knew it, though, almost as a reflex action, I was kicking at him. I'd never had formal training in martial arts, but a friend of mine in high school with some proficiency in karate had taught me a few elementary moves. Day after day, he had had me practicing kicks, nothing fancy, just training to kick as hard and high and straight as possible. This was the single most useful thing to know in an emergency, he had said. And he was right. Absorbed with swinging his bat, the man had never anticipated the possibility that he might be kicked. Just as frantic as he was, I had no idea where my kick was aimed, nor was it very strong, but the shock of it seemed to take the wind out of him. He stopped swinging his bat, and as if a break in time had occurred at that point, he stared at me with vacant eyes. Given this opportunity, I aimed a stronger, more accurate kick at his groin, and when he curled up with the pain, I wrenched the bat from his hands. Then I kicked him hard in the ribs. He tried to grab my leg, so I kicked him again, and then again in the same place. Then I smashed his thigh with the bat. Emitting a dull scream, he fell to the floor. At first I kicked and beat him out of sheer terror, so as to prevent myself from being hit. Once he fell on the floor, though, I found my terror turning to unmistakable anger. The anger was still there, the quiet anger that had welled up in my body earlier while I was walking along and thinking about Kumiko.
Released now, it flared up uncontrollably into something close to intense hatred.
I smashed the man's thigh again with the bat. He was drooling from the corner of his mouth. My shoulder and left arm were beginning to throb where he had hit me. The pain aroused my anger all the more. The man's face was distorted with pain, but he struggled to raise himself from the floor. I couldn't make my left arm work, so I threw the bat down and stood over him, smashing his face with my right hand. I punched him again and again. I punched him until the fingers of my right hand grew numb and then started to hurt. I was going to beat him until he was unconscious. I grabbed his neck and smashed his head against the wooden floor. Never in my life had I been involved in a fist fight. I'd never hit another person with all my strength, but now hitting was all I could do, and I couldn't seem to stop. My mind was telling me to stop. This was enough. Any more would be too much. The man could no longer get to his feet, but I couldn't stop. There were two of me now, I realized. I had split in two, but this me had lost the power to stop the other me. An intense chill ran through my body. Then I realized the man was smiling. Even as I went on hitting him, the man kept smiling at me. The more I hit him, the bigger the smile, until finally, with blood streaming from his nose and lips and choking on his own spit, the man gave out a high, thin laugh. He must be crazy, I thought, and I stopped punching him and stood up straight. I looked around and saw the black guitar case propped against the side of the shoe cabinet. I left the man where he lay, still laughing, and approached the guitar case. Lowering it to the floor, I opened the clasps and lifted the cover. There was nothing inside. No guitar, no candles. The man looked at me, laughing and coughing. I could hardly breathe. All of a sudden, the hot, steamy air inside this building became unbearable. The smell of mold, the feel of my own sweat, the smell of blood and saliva, my own sense of anger and hatred all became more than I could bear. I pushed the door open and went outside, closing the door behind me. As before, there was no sign of anyone in the area. All that moved was a large brown cat, slowly making its way across the vacant lot, oblivious of me. I wanted to get out of there before anyone spotted me. I wasn't sure which way I should go, but I started walking, and before long managed to find a bus stop with a sign reading to Shinjuku Station. I hoped to calm my breathing and straighten my head out before the next bus came, but failed to do either. Over and over, I told myself all I was trying to do was look at people's faces. I was just looking at the faces of people passing by on the street, the way my uncle had said.
I was just trying to untangle the simplest complications in my life, that's all. When I got on the bus, the passengers turned towards me. Each of them gave me the same shocked look, and then averted his eyes. I assumed it was because of the mark on my face. Some time passed before I realized it was because of the splatters on my white shirt of the man's blood, mostly blood from his nose, and the baseball bat I was still clutching in my hands. I ended up taking the bat all the way home with me and throwing it in a cupboard. That night, I stayed awake until the sun came up. The places on my shoulder and left arm where the man had hit me with the bat began to swell and to throb with pain, and my right fist retained the sensation of punching the man over and over and over again. The hand was still a fist, I realized, still clutched into a ball and ready to fight. I tried to relax it, but the hand would not cooperate. And where sleeping was concerned, it was less a matter of being unable to sleep than of not wanting to sleep. If I went to sleep in my present state, there was no way I could avoid having terrible dreams. Trying to calm myself, I sat at the kitchen table, taking sips of the whiskey my uncle had left with me, and listening to quiet music on the cassette player. I wanted to talk to someone. I wanted someone to talk to me. I put the telephone on the table and stared at it for hours. Call me, somebody, please, anybody, even the mysterious phone woman, I didn't care. It could be the most filthy and meaningless talk, the most disgusting and sinister conversation, it didn't matter, I just wanted someone to talk to me. But the telephone didn't ring. I finished the remaining half bottle of scotch, and after the sky grew light, I crawled into bed and went to sleep. Please don't let me dream. Please just let my sleep be a blank, if only for today. But of course I did dream. And as I had expected, it was a terrible dream. The man with the guitar case was in it. I performed the same actions in the dream as I had in reality, following him, opening the front door of the apartment building, feeling the impact of the bat, and hitting and hitting and hitting the man. But after that it was different. When I stopped hitting him and stood up, the man, drooling and laughing wildly as he had in reality, pulled a knife from his pocket, a small, sharp knife. The blade caught the faint evening glow that spilled in through the curtains, reflecting a white glimmer reminiscent of bone. But the man did not use the knife to attack me. Instead, he took all his clothes off and started to peel his own skin as if it were the skin of an apple. He worked quickly, laughing aloud all the while. The blood gushed out of him, forming a black, menacing pool on the floor. With his right hand, he peeled the skin of his left arm, and with his bloody, peeled left hand, he peeled the skin of his right arm. In the end, he became a bright red lump of flesh, but even then he went on laughing from the dark hole of his open mouth, the white eyeballs moving spasmodically against the raw lump of flesh. Soon, as if in response to the unnatural loudness of his laughter, the man's peeled skin began to slither across the floor towards me. I tried to run away, but my legs would not move. The skin reached my feet and began to crawl upward. It crept over my own skin, the man's blood-soaked skin clinging to mine and forming an overlay. The heavy smell of blood was everywhere. Soon my legs, my body, my face were entirely covered by the thin membrane of the man's skin. Then my eyes could no longer see, and the man's laughter reverberated in the hollow darkness. At that point, I woke up. Confusion and fear overtook me. For a while, I even lost hold of my own existence. My fingers were trembling. But at the same time, I knew that I had reached a conclusion. I could not, and should not, run away, not to Crete, not to anywhere. I had to get Kumiko back. With my own hands, I had to pull her back into this world. Because if I didn't, that would be the end of me. This person, this self that I thought of as me, would be lost. Book 3. The Birdcatcher. October 1984 to December 1985. 1. The Wind-Up Bird in Winter. Between the end of that strange summer and the approach of winter, my life went on without change. Each day would dawn without incident and end as it had begun. It rained a lot in September. October had several warm, sweaty days. Apart from the weather, there was hardly anything to distinguish one day from the next. I worked at concentrating my attention on the real and useful. I would go to the pool almost every day for a long swim, take walks, make myself 3 meals. But even so, every now and then I would feel a violent stab of loneliness. The very water I drank, the very air I breathed, would feel like long, sharp needles. The pages of a book in my hands would take on the threatening metallic gleam of razor blades. I could hear the roots of loneliness creeping through me when the world was hushed at 4 o'clock in the morning. And yet, there were a few people who wouldn't leave me alone. People from Kumiko's family who wrote me letters. Kumiko could not go on being married to me, they said, and so I should agree to an immediate divorce. That would supposedly solve all problems. The first few letters tried to exert pressure on me in a business-like manner. When I failed to answer, they resorted to threats and, in the end, turned to pleading. All were looking for the same thing. Eventually, Kumiko's father called. "I'm not saying that I will never agree to a divorce," I said. "But first I want to see Kumiko and talk to her, alone. If she can convince me it's what she wants, then I will give her a divorce. Only then will I agree to it." I turned towards the kitchen window and looked at the dark, rain-filled sky, stretching away into the distance. It had been raining for 4 straight days, into a wet, black world. "Kumiko and I talked everything over before we decided to get married, and if we are going to end that marriage, I want to do it the same way." Kumiko's father and I went on making parallel statements, arriving nowhere, or nowhere fruitful, at least. Several questions remained unanswered. Did Kumiko really want to divorce me, and had she asked her parents to try to convince me to go along with it?
"Kumiko says she doesn't want to see you,"
her father had told me, exactly as her brother, Noboru Wataya, had said. This was probably not an out-and-out lie. Kumiko's parents were not above interpreting things in a manner convenient to themselves, but as far as I knew, they were not the sort to manufacture facts out of nothing. They were, for better or worse, realistic people. If what her father had said was true, then was Kumiko now being sheltered by them? But that I found impossible to believe. Love was simply not an emotion that Kumiko had felt for her parents and brother from the time she was a little girl. She'd struggled for years to keep herself independent of them. It could well be that Kumiko had chosen to leave me because she had taken a lover. Even if I could not accept the explanation she had given me in her letter, I knew that it was not out of the question. But what I could not accept was that Kumiko should have gone straight from me to them or to some place they had prepared for her, and that she should be communicating with me through them. The more I thought about it, the less I understood. One possibility was that Kumiko had experienced an emotional breakdown and could no longer look after herself. Another was that she was being held against her will. I spent several days arranging and rearranging a variety of facts and words and memories until I had to give up thinking. Speculation was getting me nowhere. Autumn was drawing to a close, and a touch of winter hung in the air. As I always did at that season, I raked the dead leaves in the garden and stuffed them into plastic bags. I set a ladder against the roof and cleaned the leaves out of the gutters. The little garden of the house I lived in had no trees, but the wind carried leaves in abundance from the broad-spreading deciduous trees in the gardens on both sides. I didn't mind the work. The time would pass as I watched the withered leaves floating down in the afternoon sunshine. One big tree in the neighbor's to the right put out bright red berries. Flocks of birds would perch there and chirp as if in competition with each other. These were brightly colored birds, with short, sharp cries that stabbed the air. I wondered about how best to store Kumiko's summer clothes. I could do as she had said in her letter and get rid of them. but I remembered the care that she had given to each item, and it was not as if I had no place to keep them. I decided to leave them for the time being where they were. Still, whenever I opened the wardrobe, I was confronted by Kumiko's absence. The dresses hanging there were the husks of something that had once existed. I knew how she looked in these clothes, and to some of them were attached specific memories. I would find myself sitting on the edge of the bed, staring at the rows of dresses or blouses or skirts. I would have no idea how long I'd been sitting there. It could have been 10 minutes or an hour. Sometimes, as I sat staring at a dress, I would imagine a man I didn't know helping Kumiko out of it. His hands would slip the dress off, then go on to remove the underwear beneath. They would caress her breasts and press her thighs apart. I could see those breasts and thighs in all their white softness, and the other man's hands touching them. I didn't want to think about such things, but I had no choice. They had probably happened in reality. I had to get used to such images. I couldn't just shove reality aside. Now and then I would recall the night I slept with Greta Kano, but the memory of it was vague. I held her in my arms that night and joined my body with hers any number of times. That was an undeniable fact.
But as the weeks passed by, the feeling of certainty began to disappear.
I couldn't bring back concrete images of her body, or of the ways in which it had joined with mine. If anything, the memories of what I had done with her earlier in my mind in unreality were far more vivid than the memories of the reality of that night. The image of her mounted on me, wearing Kumiko's blue dress, in that strange hotel room, came back to me over and over again with amazing clarity. Early October saw the death of the uncle of Noboru Wataya, who had served as Niigata's representative to the lower house. He suffered a heart attack shortly after midnight in his hospital bed in Niigata, and by dawn, despite the doctor's best efforts, he was dead. The death had long been anticipated, of course, and a general election was expected shortly, so the uncle's supporters lost no time in formalizing their earlier plan to have Noboru Wataya inherit the constituency. The late representative's vote-gathering machinery was solidly based and solidly conservative. Barring some major unforeseen event, Noboru Wataya's election was assured. The first thing that crossed my mind when I read the article in a library newspaper was how busy the Wataya family was going to be from now on. The farthest thing from anybody's mind would be Kumiko's divorce. The black and blue mark on my face neither grew nor shrank. It produced neither fever nor pain. Little by little I forgot I even had it. I stopped trying to hide the mark by wearing sunglasses or a hat with the brim pulled down low. I would be reminded of it now and then when I went out shopping and people would stare at me or look away, but even these reactions stopped bothering me after a while. I wasn't harming them by having a mark on my face. I would examine it each morning when I washed and shaved, but I could see no change. Its size, color, and shape remained the same. The number of individual human beings who voiced concern about the sudden appearance of a mark on my cheek was exactly 4. The owner of the cleaning shop by the station, my barber, the young man from the Omura off-license, and the woman at the counter of the local library. In each case, when asked about it, I made a show of annoyance and said something vague, like, "I had a little accident." They would mumble, "My, my," or, "That's too bad," as if apologizing for having mentioned it. I seemed to be growing more distant from myself with each day that went by. If I stared at my hand for a while, I would begin to feel that I was looking through it. I spoke with hardly anybody. No one wrote to me or called. All I found in my mailbox were bills and junk mail, and most of the junk mail consisted of designer brand catalogs addressed to Kumiko, full of colorful photos of spring dresses and blouses and skirts. The winter was a cold one, but I sometimes forgot to turn on the heat, unsure whether the cold was real or just something inside me. I would throw the switch only after a look at the thermometer had convinced me that it really was cold. But even so, the cold I felt did not diminish.
I wrote to Lieutenant Mamiya with a general description of what had been happening to me. He might be more embarrassed than pleased to receive the letter, but I couldn't think of anyone else I could write to. I opened with that exact apology. Then I told him that Kumiko had left me on the very day he had visited my house, that she had been sleeping with another man for some months, that I had spent almost 3 days at the bottom of a well thinking, that I was now living here all alone, and that the keepsake from Mr. Honda had been nothing but an empty whiskey box. Lieutenant Mamiya sent me an answer a week later.
To tell you the truth, you have been in my thoughts to an uncanny degree since we last met. I left your home feeling that we really ought to go on talking, to spill our guts to each other, so to speak, and the fact that we did not has been no small source of regret to me. Unfortunately, however, some urgent business had come up which required me to return to Hiroshima that night. Thus, in a certain sense, I was very glad to receive a letter from you. I wonder if it was not Mr. Honda's intention all along to bring the two of us together. Perhaps he believed that it would be good for me to meet you and for you to meet me. The division of keepsakes may well have been an excuse to have me visit you. This may explain the empty box. My visit to you itself would have been his keepsake. I was amazed to hear that you had spent time down in a well, for I, too, continue to feel myself strongly attracted to wells. Considering my own close call, one would think that I would never have wanted to see another well, but quite the contrary. Even to this day, whenever I see a well, I can't help looking in. And if it turns out to be a dry well, I feel the urge to climb down inside. It may be that I continue to hope I will encounter something down there, but if I go down inside and simply wait, it will be possible for me to encounter a certain something. Not that I expect it to restore my life to me. No, I am far too old to hope for such things. What I hope to find is the meaning of the life that I have lost. By what was it taken away from me? And why? I want to know the answers to these questions with absolute certainty, and I would go so far as to say that if I could have those answers, I would not mind being even more profoundly lost than I am already. Indeed, I would gladly accept such a burden, for whatever years of life may be left to me. I was truly sorry to hear that your wife had left you. But that is a matter on which I am unable to offer you any advice. I have lived far too long a time without the benefit of love or family, and am thus unqualified to speak on such matters. I do believe, however, that if you feel the slightest willingness to wait a while longer for her to come back, then you should probably continue to wait there as you are doing now. That is my opinion. For what it is worth. I realize full well how hard it must be to go on living alone in a place from which someone has left you. But there is nothing so cruel in this world as the desolation of having nothing to hope for. If possible, I would like to come to Tokyo in the near future and see you again. But unfortunately, I'm having a little problem with one leg, and the treatment for it will take some time. Please take care, and be well.
Sometimes I climbed the garden wall and went down the winding alley to where the vacant Miyawaki house had stood. Dressed in a three-quarter-length coat, a scarf wrapped under my chin, I trod the alley's dead winter grass. Short puffs of frozen winter wind whistled through the electric lines overhead. The house had been completely demolished, the yard now surrounded by a high plank fence. I could look in through the gaps in the fence, but there was nothing to see. No house, no paving stones, no well, no trees, no TV aerial, no bird sculpture. Just a flat, black stretch of cold-looking earth,
compacted by the tracks of a bulldozer and a few scattered clumps of weeds. I could hardly believe there had once been a deep well in the yard, and that I had climbed down into it. I leaned against the fence, looking up at May Kasahara's house,